I think on a serious note, I think you'd be like, a serpent, like a snake.
Gorilla.
A
serpent.
No, I'd be like one of those laughing hyenas.
Sloth. What's a sloth? I think of sloth when I look at you.
Welcome back to another edition of After the Whistle. We should set it up by saying I'm sat in France on a World War One Battlefields tour with our sixth form schools from Parkhouse, Melksham and Rawwood and Bassett, who are part of our Mad Dog rugby programmes. So I'm here in France. Leon is back with us, having holidayed around Japan for 3 weeks. Leon, where are you?
Oh, very rude. But it's great to be back on UK soil. I'm back in sunny Leicestershire.
Oh, my word, you sound like you've been on a three-week bender.
Are you joking? Please don't start with that.
So we've got a World Cup to talk about before we mention that. We're also leading into an interview with David Richmond that we recorded a couple of weeks ago now, but a fascinating chat where he was talking about the resilience, the champion mindset. He was also the UK's highest ranking officer ever to be wounded in Afghanistan. So getting into, you know, how that was, that must have been incredibly challenging, the mental frustrations and how that was perceived. And of course, his transition now. Where is he now? What is he up to? So an exciting podcast ahead. But before we do that, you've obviously been in Japan. So we need to dive into the World Cup final, that small event that happened at the weekend, mate. You were there. You lead off. You tell me, what was it like? Were you actually in the stadium at the final?
I was in the stadium, got there very early to make sure, because the traffic was quite busy. You know, they've got a few people that I'd found that arrived at the same. There's two big stadiums in Yokohama. And the amount of people that missed the start of the game because they went to the wrong stadium, because they went to the Japanese stadium, not the international stadium. They were devastated to miss the start. This just puts in perspective how big the place is and how big the country is. And the taxi drivers, you say, you go there wearing your England shirt or your Springbok shirt and you say, take me to Yokohama Stadium. They don't assume you mean Yokohama International Stadium where the match is being played. They take you to where the empty stadium where there's nothing happening, where the baseball's played. So lots of people foul of that, but glad the eye didn't.
And how did... I sat in the front room with the family, with my boys, Dylan and Ethan. Actually, Dylan had to leave at 9:30 because he had a football game, of all things, bless him. He was very disappointed, but... They streamed the game in the car on the way down. And I think he was delighted he went in the end after the result. But it was one of those. I had friends, family around. We all got the England shirts out, my historic England jerseys. And
you still fit into that? Surprised?
It was actually, it was a bit tight.
Baggy around the chest, but tight everywhere else.
Yeah, sorry about that. But I even got one of my Irish neighbours to hold an England jersey for a brief period of time. So it was.
Hey, on that, Lewis, one of the big things I remember, I was fortunate to sit next to Gavin, the legend, Gavin Hastings, and he was sat next to me for the final. And when God Save the Queen when the anthems came on, he was singing it next to me, and I looked at him thinking, no. And I looked at him, he just gave me a wry wink, and I said, afterwards, I said, mate, that's awesome that you're supporting us. Well, I'm supporting the Northern Hemisphere. He said, and besides, I want to beat the world champions in February when you come up to Murrayfield. But it was fascinating to see, you know, the old enemy, Scotland, that he was there supporting us, which was great.
Well, that is nice, because I know I saw Dave Flatman sent a tweet out talking about the Welsh and actually some of the comments that came from, there was a video, I think, of a Welsh rugby club that decides to support the Springboks for the morning. And when the Springboks won, we're cheering the result. So I think it's nice to hear, because I like to think that as Englishmen, we'd be like, if Wales had made it to the final, I 100% would have been supporting Wales. And it's lovely to hear that guys like Gav would support England. But what did he and you make of the game? Because I know on the TV, you know, it's so close for, you know, 40, 60 minutes. And then obviously the Springboks ran away with it. But really, it only to me felt like there was one team ever looking likely to score. And that was actually South Africa. How did it feel in the stadium?
You know, you have the benefit of replays and different angles with when you watch it on TV. The game for us, everyone was whinging that it was just so stop-start. Obviously, you had that unfortunate injury to Carl Singh at the beginning after 2.5 minutes. And it just seemed for us, because you haven't got the commentary, you haven't got the reviews, it seemed like the game took a long time to get going. And you're right, it did feel like there's only one team controlling it and pulling the strings. But it got to half-time, there's a minute to go, and I think it was 9-6. And I said to Gavin, look, 9-6 is a great first half result for us. And then we give away a penalty and we go in 12-6, which is not as good. So yeah, it was quite a flat first start, but that's always going to be the way I thought after the how well England played against New Zealand, to replicate that would have been phenomenal. The one thing we did talk about was, I don't know how many times a team's gone on to win the World Cup and beaten the top three teams. So England played Australia, New Zealand and South Africa. And normally one of those two teams would knock one of them out, you know, so you wouldn't have to play all the big ones. So for England to win the World Cup, they were going to have to do it possibly the hardest way of all. So it was always going to be a big ask. It was in their gift, but unfortunately just come up short, I suppose.
And I was so watching at home, it felt like a really exciting game. It's a World Cup final for, you know, for goodness sakes, you're watching on the TV, watching all the build up, you know, people are coming around, the croissants are warming, the coffee's brewing, and sitting there and as the game evolves. One of the things I thought during the week building up to the final was that it was always going to come down to a kicking contest. And the first half felt like that, didn't it? You know, you seesawed 3 points one way, 3 points the other. But also, everyone, you talked about then replicating the performance from the All Blacks. For me, it was always going to be not about replicating. It was going to be about putting in the performance you need to beat the Springboks. And I remember just one memory I had of playing South Africa, having had a big win prior to it. We beat Australia in 2010 at Twickenham by record score. Ben Youngs fed Chris Ashton on our goal line. Chris went the length. We beat him by 20-odd points or more. And 2 weeks later, we played the Springboks, who'd lost a series of games coming into that. I think they might have lost to the Irish as well coming into that. So all of a sudden, we're buoyed, we're confident going in, thinking, the Springboks have lost to Ireland. We beat them in the Six Nations. You know, we're going to be all over this. And of course, that didn't transpire. We were bullied off the park. We were out physical, we were out muscle, we were out thought. And it just felt like that's sort of what happened at the weekend. You know, it was never going to be the same game. South Africa were never going to allow England, the speed of ball that they had against New Zealand. They slowed everything down. England had barely any possession in the first half. I mean, it was just, it was a masterstroke by South Africa. They got everything right. And I don't know what you feel about the little battles, but for me, the little battles, winning every small battle or the next battle is so key to having that big outcome. And it just felt like England fell off all the little important battles.
I think that you're right. At that level, it's about attention to detail, you know, all the little cliches, winning those little battles, the small margins. And the fact that England went into that game 80 minutes fresher, in my mind, I thought that was a huge advantage. You know, there's less knocks on the body. So I thought, you know, that put some positive, you know, psychologically, that put some an advantage. Whether it does or not on the pitch, I don't know, but psychologically, they're fresher. The fact they turned up, I don't know if you know, but they turned up half an hour late to the match. So than normal, that would have had an impact on how they prepared for that match, how they turned up. You've got a routine before kickoff. I'm not saying that's an excuse. I'm not saying that's the reason why they lost, because you're still there, professional. But all those little things add up. You know, straight away, you're an hour before kickoff where you turn up, and then you lose your prop in the first few minutes. All those little things add up to being, you know, the 1-2-3 percenters.
Eddie rehearsed that. I think it was about a year ago, maybe 18 months ago, or it might have been earlier. They actually rehearsed being late to one of the games in the, I think it was the Autumn Internationals.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, so they had covered it. I mean, he's a forward-thinking bloke, but you're right, it still upsets your rhythm, doesn't it, pre-game? Oh, one of the other sort of, I suppose, main talking points we just need to cover off is there's been a lot of uproar over the fact that the England boys took their medals off after the game. And I think people forget very quickly, you know, what it's like to be involved in a major competition. Like those guys, they're not preparing to come second. You know, their goal isn't to win a silver medal. You don't look at a World Cup like gold, silver, bronze. You look at it about winning a World Cup. England would have been prepared for that game and that final for the last two years, whatever, you know, however long Eddie's been there now. So we have to put it into perspective for them. Losing in the final is losing. You know, they don't feel like they've achieved or won anything. And I hope in hindsight and looking back that they can actually see making a World Cup final, beating the best teams in the world to get there, an achievement. But I do understand the mindset about, you know, not necessarily appreciating the medal, a runners-up medal.
It's raw. You know, when that happens, you don't go, you know, in champion mindset, you know, what David Richmond going to talk about, where if you're not first, you're last. You know, if you don't win, it doesn't matter if you come second, third, fourth, fifth. You know, the history books won't say, oh, that a team played really well in the semi-final. The history books records who you win. And I know that I've seen on social media people saying, well, the All Blacks were respectful and they wore their medals, but the All Blacks went in and they had a chance of winning a medal or not, and they won a medal. Whereas England, they were going in to win a gold medal. They weren't going in there to win a silver medal, like you just said. So I think it's very different. And if it's just happened and the devastation and the whole thing build up to it, I can appreciate the reactions that the players had, because I've been there. You know, we've all been there. We've all been in big finals where we expect to win and you don't win. It's horrendous.
Well, I remember being in a change room with you in 07 and, you know, getting that runners-up European Cup medal, which went straight in the bin. And, you know, it was exactly as you said. It was raw emotion. It was like, this is, you know, we've spent all season building up to this moment. We've won a Premier League. We've won the Cup. We've not celebrated anything. Those two achievements in itself, you know, were very worthy of celebration. One would have been worthy of celebration. We held out until that third final, which was the Heineken Cup, and we lost. And the devastation after losing that meant that the medal went in the bin, the little tankard you got. And you are just operating in raw emotion. So I totally get that. You must have had a moment like that after a final.
Yeah, well, remember we talked about with Wayne about the danger is we live, you know, elite mindset. You live in the now. So you never stop and go, wow, look where we are, look what we've achieved. You're always thinking, well, what's next? So you win the league, great, we won it. What's next? You win the cup, right, now we're going to win the treble. You never actually stop and think, well, we didn't win the treble, but we still won two trophies. Because your mindset is always around what's next, you know, better never stops. All those things that's drilled into you. And that'll be why the boys will be so disappointed. And, you know, like we've lost in lots of finals. I think I've lost in five finals. During my Leicester career, I lost in five finals. You know, you forget about them because they're irrelevant. But they're not irrelevant because to get to a final, you've achieved a lot more than what other people have. But, you know, it's just, unless you've been there, I think it's very difficult to explain to people.
I think you mentioned Wayne there. Was that episode two that we did? Do you go back and listen to it? Because he has a fantastic take on mindset and everything. But I remember I think it's perspective as well. And what is, you know, what is success for you? Because if I go back to 2007, having won it in 03 and actually in 07, making the final was our World Cup moment, you know. So actually I did quite treasure the 07 World Cup medal that we got because there was a different reason for it. You know, we'd made a final through all adversity. We didn't deserve to be there. We weren't good enough really to be there. It was through sheer bloody mindedness and determination that we got there. You know, players taking control. You know, we narrowly beat Australia. We beat France. And we lost to South Africa. But we were in disarray really during the tournament. So for us, the perspective was game at the time was just getting out the pools. And then it was, okay, can we get through Australia? Okay, we've got past Australia. Can we get past France? How are we going to do that? Okay, we're in a World Cup final. How can we win this game from a team that beat us 36-0 only 4 weeks before? So
yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Lewis. You said you didn't deserve to be there. You know, all the way through, you felt like you didn't deserve to be there. So you were content with a silver medal, whereas this current crop, I think they felt they deserved to be there. And I think they felt they were going into that match as possibly favourites, having just destroyed the previous world champion. So if they'd have probably limped their way into the final, would they have reacted differently? I don't know. I've never been in that situation. But I think that comparing that 07 side to this side, I think we were comparing your 03 side to this side and how you guys would have responded having lost that, then you probably would have felt different in 03 losing that one than you did in 07. And also, you'd already won one, so that's just being greedy.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I totally agree. You got that bang on. I suppose it's easy to, you know, look down on it, but actually I really hope this England side and Eddie Jones can build from here. Yes, be disappointed because their goal was to win a World Cup and they set themselves up brilliantly to do so. And, you know, ultimately they can just put their hands up and say, sometimes we're beaten by a better side on the day. And that is exactly what happened. There's nothing you can do. It wasn't a mistake, you know, by one person that cost them the game. It wasn't a piece of brilliance that changed the course of the match. It was just all over the park. England were soundly beaten. It was a fantastic World Cup. Let's say that I loved every minute of watching it with my boys from home. I loved the build up. I loved how Japan took to the tournament. I loved how Japan played in the tournament. You know, some of the results like Uruguay beating Fiji. You know, there were just some wonderful moments. Some of the tries that were scored. That Josh Adams try against Australia, offload from Jonathan Davis. There's been some brilliant moments. And of course, that win for England against New Zealand, a cracking tournament. And let's look forward to 2023 now. But before we do that, we've got a little interview with our good friend, David Richmond. Let's get stuck into that.
Now, David had a 26-year military career and held various demanding positions within the Ministry of Defence. He's also the highest ranked officer to be shot and wounded in Afghanistan, survived, thankfully, which is why he's here with us, with us today. He went on to be a director of recovery services for Help for Heroes, director of UK Invictus Games for the first 3 years, chairman of Boccia, the UK Paralympic sport, and also holds numerous charity positions and roles, as well as being a keynote speaker. And David, welcome. And did you ever think of actually going on and achieving anything with your life?
No.
I mean, that is some list of achievements.
I sort of bumble along through the people, say, what's your great plan? I've never had a great plan. I just sort of see what comes. And it's fun. I like getting involved in lots of different things. So it's nice to be here.
I've noted down here that you might be a Bath season ticket holder as well. Is that true?
I might be, yes. I have two tickets. I always like to go with somebody. And enjoy sitting in the rain in the stand at Bath watching a labour of love, I think it's been recently.
That stand really is atrocious, isn't it? I mean, I've been down there now and sat out and watched as a fan that I am. And I think I lasted about 30 minutes watching the first game, and I was like, no, I'm not sitting in the pouring rain. I've got way too posh. You know, Leon obviously would have been there, Kovskin grafting out in the way. Actually, you wouldn't have been sat in Bath, would you? No way. You wouldn't have lowered your standards.
Me. I'll go anywhere to watch a game of rugby. Diehard fan.
And mate, so let's talk. Obviously, myself and Leon played rugby for a long time. So as you're a Bath fan, give me your brief reflections on the season last year and how you feel about the season going forward. We've got Stuart Hooper in now as... Last year was a
sort of flatter to deceive season, wasn't it, I think, in that it promised a huge amount. I think there were lots of areas of the game that you could see distinct improvement over the year before, but we just seemed to at times lose any sense of game plan. Couldn't close anything off. And when the pressure's on, I don't think we're making the right decisions. But you live and learn, and change of people at the top, which I thought was a surprise. Mm. And good luck to Stuart Hooper. I think he's got a big job in his hands. Your first big coaching job, really. And taking a hugely ambitious team with a hugely ambitious owner into the Premiership. So I sort of give him my wholehearted support and best wishes. But it's a steep hill to climb, and good luck to him.
I'll pass that on to Hoops. Our kids play in the same cricket team together. But it's interesting you say that, because a good friend of ours, Jordan Murphy, as well, has just taken over at Leicester. So two of my old clubs have got two of my closest mates now in charge. Probably, one of the hardest periods in both clubs' history. Mm. Leicester almost getting relegated last year. And Bath, with Bruce Craig doing, so much good stuff and Bath being so promising, actually, where do they fit going forward? It's going to be a challenging position. Maybe they need someone with a bit of leadership experience, 26 years in the military to offer.
You never know. You've got my number, pass it on.
Did you play rugby?
I did. I played all the way through school. I played at Worcester as I left. I didn't play at England level, played at representative level below that. And I loved it. It was I've always played sport, and rugby was absolutely at the heart of what I did. And actually, because I always wanted to go into the military, as I was just at that decision point where you either go on and play this, although my day it was an amateur game. I was also playing cricket and was involved at Worcestershire. And just at the point where
Worcester County cricket?
Yeah.
Wait, really?
Yeah, so I played in the under-25s and second team there. So it was one of those things where, just as they're saying, okay, are you going to do this or what, was the sort of discussion then.
Yeah.
I'd already sort of decided Sandhurst was the place I was going to head, and I'd pass the entrance for that. So I made the decision to go there. And I don't regret it for a minute. I had a brilliant military career. But really, I say that because sport's always been at the heart of who I am as a person, quite apart from what I do as a profession. And I see much more the huge power of sport, not just for the people on the field and for what happens on the field, but for everything that surrounds what you're doing on the field. That recreational level of sport is so important in society, I think, quite apart from the elite level that you guys have been involved in, and I am now as a sort of chair of Botcha. But we mustn't forget the base of that pyramid, which does so much in society.
How much sport can you actually compete in or get involved in when you're in the military? Is that door closed and you're sort of focused on the job in hand?
There's a huge amount. I mean, that's one of the great attractions, actually. You can, depending on your sort of deployment routine, operational deployment, you can get involved to really, I mean, well, yourself, you think of the Tim Rompers of the world and lots like him who were army off. He was an army officer of the Underwoods.
Yeah, Josh Lucy, Will Carling. Although I'm not sure Josh actually ever served, but he got through Sandhurst.
That's right. Yeah. So there was huge potential to go on and compete at an elite level, but also just participate. So the army came under a lot of pressure, I think, particularly when Iraq and Afghanistan were rumbling along together, when people were bouncing and you were passing your own reflection, going between deployments and training for deployment, and sports suffered as a consequence because the time wasn't there. But I took a view as a CO, as we were getting ready for Afghanistan in 2008. Why shouldn't sport take place. If you don't make time for it, you'll find other stuff to do. So we still, in the run-up to Afghanistan, we still had a football team that got to the Army Finals. We had a boxing team which got to the Army Finals. We had, yeah, we focused on those two sports, but also did a variety of other things. So if you want to make time for it, you can go and do it.
And it galvanised, you know, sport, regardless of the sport. I think if you're able to play sport for a job,
yeah,
it's the best job in the world. And I'm slightly biased, but it just galvanises you. It brings everyone together. When times are tough, you go and play sport. You know, when times are great, you can play sport. You sort of, everything's forgotten about. So it's good that you can still do that as well as having such a serious day job, if you like.
It's quite impressive as well to see someone like Rocco Degooni, who's come through the military.
Absolutely,
and actually have a... I think he was spotted playing for the army.
Yeah.
And then taken to Bath, and has obviously gone on to play for England as well. But it's fascinating to see those crossovers. But in terms of, you spoke about sport being important to you as a young man. You made that decision. What was an early military life like for you? So what was young David, did you always want to be in the army?
I did, and I remember going to my commissions board in, crikey, early 80s, and being asked the inevitable, the obvious question, why do you want to be an army officer? And my answer, I said, I'm going to be, it's slightly necky, because I did this, I went to my commissions board at 17. I said, well, it's slightly necky, because I always have wanted to. If you said why, I'm not really sure why. I wasn't able to articulate it at that stage, but I said, I'd never really wanted to do anything else. And I don't, if you said it was, do you have a family history in the military? No, we don't. My grandfather served in the Second World War. My father didn't, his brothers didn't, and therefore there's no military history in the family, but I just always wanted to do it. And as I went to, even as I look back now on a career which ended more abruptly than I'd perhaps planned, I have absolutely no regrets. I really enjoyed it, and I would do it all over again. And I would recommend it to any young person who's like-minded, likes a challenge, physical challenge, wants to work with people, will learn a lot about themselves, will be placed in position of real responsibility, potentially very, very early, and in an environment which is designed to support you. So, I look back on that with, not through rose-tinted specs, but very, I look back and I think, I'm really glad I did that.
I've done a bit of researching recently just into military stuff on my ancestors that were involved, but I also really wanted to join the army when I was leaving school. But thankfully or not, rugby turned professional literally that summer. So the decision was sort of taken out of your hands. Do you join the military, which I'd always wanted to do, or do you go do the one thing that you've absolutely loved as a kid growing up? And I think I would have really enjoyed my time in the military. Do you ever?
It did actually. I was in the cadets before.
You were never in the cadets.
I was in the cadets, yep.
At school?
No, I was too young. So I joined the cadets when I was too young. When they found out my age, I was too young. They kicked me out. and then I sort of fell into rugby. But yeah, my dad was in the Territorial Army. And I sort of, in my mind, I was one of those young kids where I saw something on TV. I wanted to do that. So, and I saw lots of movies around being in the army. And that was, for me, I thought it would give me the discipline as a young lad growing up in a city, Coventry. But you know, it wasn't meant to be. I think when I went down the sporting route, that the military side went away. I know that we always laugh and joke about your unfulfilled potential in wearing a uniform, but that was never there for me. But as a young boy, certainly it was in my top three career choices.
Do you think rugby? So we've spoken in the past about rugby being quite a means to taking you off what could have been an otherwise, you know, slightly dodgy existence in Cov. You know, potentially going down the wrong route with certain characters. Do you think the military could have played a similar role if sport hadn't come along?
Definitely, the discipline instilled. I think that there's so many parallels. You know, that's why we're here. There's so many parallels from the military to the sporting world. The structure, the discipline, the camaraderie, the teamship, the winning, or the leadership, all those things, the resilience, all those things which cross over. But you go back when you were a young boy, you don't realise that's what it is. Retrospectively looking back, definitely that's the discipline that I certainly would have needed.
David, I'm sure Leon's told you numerous times how bad his knees are and what hardships he had playing. How he had to retire when he was 29.
Yeah,
30. 30.
Managed to get to 30.
But, you know, that is something completely different to getting shot at or physically actually shot. So, you know, for us, we can recover, you know, with all the physios and everything like that. What was it like for you? I mean, what is that?
It's a long old. It comes as no surprise. I mean, getting shot is not a pleasant experience, but it comes with the turf. So it's not. It wasn't. You know, I didn't feel hard done by, so to speak. I mean, I'd much rather it hadn't happened. But but it comes with the turf. So in that sense, I suppose I was mentally prepared for that. Although you do think when you're the commanding officer, it's probably not going to happen to you, but then it does. And you know, well, just live with it, get on with it. And
as someone else, so I don't know much about the inner working. So as a commanding officer, how come you were so close to the action? Because I would always perceive you guys would be way back sort of.
Yeah, because it was a big, it was a battle group operation. So that's, you know, that's, we had several hundred people out on the ground. And because it's at that level, then the CO goes out. You know, I went out with my battery group tactical headquarters. And the nature of Afghanistan was that, you know, there wasn't a front and a back. You know, the Taliban could be all around you, could be anywhere at any point. And that's how we, as a battle group headquarters, ended up in a firefight, and that's where I got shot. And then you start this sort of long rehab and recovery. So for me, the bullet shattered my right femur and I lost 10 centimetres of bone. And I was very lucky they didn't take my leg off, actually. They thought about doing that in Camp Bassi and then decided against it, much to my relief.
Would have hampered your bowling.
Would have hampered my bowling. Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure my golf would have been too good either. Mine is not too good now, and I've still got two legs.
Definitely been better than Leon's, for sure. I played the other day, it was terrible.
Yeah. You mentioned, I want to come back to that, David, but you mentioned a point there when I first met David. I'm going to say this is quite embarrassing. It's not going to paint me in a good light. We were playing golf over in La Manga, supporting the WASS Legends Foundation. Yeah. And I'd had a few rosés the night before, and I turned up late for the tea.
Rosé, your drink of choice, obviously.
I turned up for the tea in my usual typical style, complaining about my cartilage and my knees, and my knees are aching. And then I looked across, and we were playing with was it Bernie, a double leg amputee. And I hadn't realised I was there playing golf, and I'm complaining about my, oh lads, I don't think I'm going to get to the nine holes, and realised we were playing with Bernie, who had a double amputee, David, and Gary.
Gary, yeah, he's only got one arm.
He had one arm. And then there was me whinging on the first tee. Yeah. And I think they actually got taught a golfing lesson that day.
Yeah. I finished. You get taught a golfing lesson every time you go on the golf course, mate.
Yeah, true.
Although you did beat me the other day, didn't you? But let's come back to David rather than you, if that's all right.
Sorry,
I know your knees are still bad, and we'll hear more about it later.
David, you've had a grade 2 hamstring tear. They are terrible.
Yeah, if you need to stand up and walk around a bit, just switch yourself off.
They take a bullet the lid any day of the week.
Yeah, it went off with a twisted sock. Yeah.
I got so much abuse once for
the way you dress.
No, at least I've got an iron. At least I've got an iron.
Different day.
We're talking about the military. Would he get into the army with a shirt like that? Like, he's never seen an iron.
Probably not.
That's sight alone.
Yeah, but you'd have a rough time. A rough time. Yeah.
But let's go back to you. So I want to understand just the mindset of what it's like, because we've been through injuries and that recovery process, but nothing compares to what you would have had to go through.
I think when I look back, I think that what you have to do, I mean, it took me 4 years from injury to being sort of signed off by the consultant as being sort of back on the road, albeit slightly damaged. And what you had to do is just keep your eyes on what I used to describe as the big prize. Where did you want to get to? And then work really hard to get there and not be. And so keeping your eyes on the big prize, as I've always described it, just, I think, helps you not be totally flawed and deflated by the setbacks you get along the way.
What was the big prize, though? When you're there, it's very difficult to know what the big prize, what is it?
Well, for me, I wanted to get back to being active, to play with my children again, and hopefully return into service. Well, I managed the first two, didn't manage the last one, and that's not too bad a result, to be honest. So for me, being active, I wanted to be able to run again, I wanted to be able to ride a bike and to do, you know, the kind of stuff that... that would keep me sort of fit and healthy. And my children were sort of young teenagers at the time, and I wanted to be able to, you know, still go and do stuff with them. And I sort of kept myself so fixed on that, so that when the bumps along the way happen, you know, you get your setbacks and your recovery doesn't work as well as it is, or the surgery doesn't work, or whatever it is, you can sort of, you are deflated. Of course, you have a bit of a, oh, you're not again. But then you sort of fix your eyes back on where you want to be, and you work really hard to go and do it. And I think the thing that helps... Well, there's a few things that help that. One is you have to be clear in your mind that the only person who can do your rehab is you. Lots of people can help you, but actually the person who really has to do it is you. And that's fundamentally different from the sort of acute end of surgery where people are sort of doing stuff to you. It helps if you engage in it, but actually they're going to do it anyway. Mm. But then the sort of mindset has to flip to this is now up to you. So, you know, don't put weight on, work hard. Do what they've asked you to do, and if anything, do more. Although there's a fine balance in that. And then you need a sort of supportive group of friends and family around you who can sort of, you know, both stabilise you when you're having a bit of a wobble and give you a slap on the head every now and then if you've been an idiot, just encourage you along the way.
How did that support network? So you mentioned your family there. How did they cope? Obviously, they know you're in the army, but they wouldn't ever. How did they deal with that? How did they deal with the father getting shot, husband getting shot?
It's really tough, and I think, you know, for us, we'd been married, but for crikey. My wife will listen to this and she'll think, can't remember how long we've been married. Whatever, it must have been about 20 years.
We'll edit that.
Say that now, honestly.
We've been married, when was it, 2008? Yeah, so we'd been married for almost 20 years by then. And therefore, she was very familiar with the routine of me going away. And the girls had both grown up with me going away and doing things. I think the bit that we underestimated or hadn't really recognised when I went to Afghanistan this time was that the girls were now, they were just 11 and just 13 when I was wounded. Of course, at that age, they're old enough now to realise not only have you gone away, but they probably know where you've gone, and they're beginning to understand what the risks are, and then it happens. Yeah. And that's really tough for them because, of course, I think any child's dad is indestructible, and especially if you're in uniform and you walk around with a rifle and all this kind of stuff. And then they see that you're really not indestructible and they see you at your weakest, and that really does knock them. And that's really tough. And it's tough for your wife, of course, who has had that knock on the door one night that they all fear when you're away. Life turns upside down, not least of which because although they know you've been shot and you're coming back, you don't know what the long-term prognosis is. You don't know if you've got a career left or not. There's lots of things you don't know other than it's going to be a long haul. And people often will say, you know, recovery from an injury is a serious injury. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And the sentiment behind that's dead right. But the difference between that marathon and the one you're about to enter is normally when you enter a marathon, you've done it deliberately. You've trained for it. You know when it's going to start and you know it's going to be 26.2 miles long. And all you need to do is propel yourself to the end. When this happens, you weren't expecting it and you don't know how long it is. So you need to have that sort of mental resilience and the endurance just to get yourself to the end, wherever the end happens to be. And everybody's in it. So the setbacks you have don't just affect you, they affect your family. You know, they ride that whole roller coaster with you. So the support network, which is friends and family, the friends, I think, are also supporting the family who are supporting you. So it's a sort of much more sort of interlinked support network than maybe you recognise at the time, I guess.
What you've just explained then, that's a true definition of resilience. Mm. Where do you think you developed that? Do you think you developed that as a young boy? Was it in your early years in the military? Is it your sporting thing? Is it a bit of all of it? Where do you think you developed that? Do you need strong resilience to get through that?
I think you sort of, you develop it over time. I think I was lucky. I had a really stable family life. I had, you know, I think my parents were quite traditional in many ways and they didn't suffer fools gladly in lots of ways. And they emphasize about standing on your own two feet and looking after yourself and all that kind of business. And being your own man, I remember being talked about that. And that sort of starts to build you up. And also they were very supportive while doing that, also really supportive. Then the whole military training bit is about, success in adversity and your independence and looking after yourself and all these things. So I think there are lots of components, and also it character-wise, I like lots of, I suppose, people of military guys or sportsmen in many ways. I'm just stubborn at times. You just need the bloody mindedness to batter on, and keep fixed on what you want to achieve. And I think if anything, I probably took that to a point where my stubbornness and bloody mindedness was really helpful for the first really hard days. And then sort of got in the way at the point at which I was failing to recognise that life had changed and I was going to have to leave. And I had a bit of a eureka moment one day when somebody asked me at Headley Court, the rehab centre, you know, how are you doing today? And I'd sort of, right, now you've asked, I'm going to tell you. And as I was sort of verbalising how I felt about lots of things, the sort of light bulb went on and it was, okay, you've just answered your own question. Something needs to change. You need to decide to... The conscious decision then was, I need to leave.
Was there an element of, we've talked about this before, you know, would you say as strong as an element of denial going up to that point, that you're still chasing that dream of staying in, but you didn't want to, once you're out type of thing?
Yeah. I think there was a bit of denial. There was a bit of, I was just so single-minded about getting to that sort of big prize that I wasn't prepared to consider any form of failure. And then, of course, reality hits that, you're not going to go back to be a fully deployable serviceman. It's just not going to happen. So I think in the course of talking to the, it was a social worker, Headley, just happened to ask me in the corridor, how am I doing today? As I sort of unloaded at her, or to her rather than at her, the light bulb went on. I thought, actually, I think I know what the answer is now. And I could feel almost from that moment, a weight came off. I was nobody was putting pressure on me apart from me, actually. So once I'd recognised that, I could feel the pressure coming off. And then, actually, it's then replaced by other pressures. Okay, you're gonna, what are you going to do now? But yeah, that's another story probably.
Do you think some of that stubbornness and actually the way, I know through my sporting career anyway, at least sometimes verbalising your feelings and your emotions were not, they just never really happened, certainly when we came through. And I know I was diagnosed with bowel disease when I was younger, and I spent years not talking about it at all, and that added more pressure and more pressure. But then listening to what you're saying there, as soon as you verbalise what you're going through and you can express it, actually realise you take the burden and the pressure off yourself.
Yeah, you sort of give yourself permission to express it, don't you? You don't. You give yourself permission to talk to somebody else about it, sharing what you're going through. And in the course of that, you know, as I say, that's a light bulb went on. So completely the same thing. You know, it's just as you verbalise it, you just begin. I think I don't know the psychology behind it, but it seems to trigger, it makes other connections in your mind that made the future for me much clearer.
There's certainly an element of acceptance as you go through. I know that we talk, and I sort of talk to lots of athletes who are battling back from injury, and they're either putting off the transition, which they don't want, the inevitable, and only once when they've actually come out and said, "Do you know what? It's done. I cannot come back." They all have this sense of relief. They didn't want to say it, but once it actually, when it's final, sometimes that decision's not theirs. They don't make that decision. But once it's happened and then there's an acceptance of things have changed, things are different, what's my next challenge? Yeah. That relief goes, and then you can focus on what the next big challenge is.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also there's a recognition in my mind that although I was, what would I be, 42-ish, just shy of 42 when I was shot, so I'd be 46 when I left, I still had more working life left.
I was going to ask you that. Where would you be?
Yeah. Then I'd already spent. So although I thought 26 years is a long time to do anything, I still had more to go.
More to go. Where do you think you'd be if you were still in there? Would you still be in there? What was the big prize for you in your career?
Well, I never really had a career plan, but it seemed to work for me in that I've always believed, and I still do, is do the job you're in really well, and what will come will come. Now, in the military, because you're selected for things, what will come in a more sort of, you react to that, although you influence it by your performance. In civilian life, of course, what will come because it opens doors for you, and maybe you're making applications to things or people are inviting you to things that otherwise they wouldn't have done if you'd been rubbish because you were too busy worrying about the next thing. I've always believed, worry about what you're doing now and do that really well. And it served me. But I mean, not everybody can do that. I mean, some people are planners, aren't they? They need to have a plan. And I often talk when I'm coaching, doing the sort of leadership or exec coaching, about developing a sort of framework in your mind about, or a plan about where you want to go. But it doesn't work for everybody. So it's just the way I was sort of wired.
I think that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because when you're at school, everyone's like, well, what's your plan? What are you going to do? Or when you leave rugby, or the middle, what's your plan? What are you going to do? And then when you have to say, well, actually, I don't know, it feels like you're failing or you're wrong. Why haven't you got a plan? But actually, I think sometimes it's just, well, for me, anyway, it's just been about going out and doing something. When you go to uni, you get a degree, you then just go and get a job. It's not necessarily even linked to what you've done a degree in.
Yeah.
And then you see where that path takes you.
Yeah, and it's a be comfortable with that uncertainty.
Mm.
And I think actually, in a much wider sense, life is much more uncertain anyway. So if you're not comfortable with uncertainty, you're just going to get more and more uncomfortable as the world sort of speeds up around you. And that's why I think your resilience now is in individuals, whether they're sportsmen or they're recovering from injury, whatever profession they're in, is just more important. That's your human resilience piece. And it's much more demanding now in a world where I think people are more atomized than ever before. You know, people are stuck to phones and social media and computers and emails and all that kind of stuff. And actually the human relationships are the bits that start to fall away. But when trauma happens, when something happens, it's the human relationships which mend you. It's the bit, that's what heals you, not, you know, and I don't mean, you know, of course the medics do their stuff, but the bit that heals you in terms of you know, making you feel how you feel and how you feel about the future, that's other people. And therefore that resilience is around relationships and ability to form relationships. And you have it in rugby with teammates and colleagues and people you've been involved in the larger rugby community. I had it in the military and actually that's that network of people and how you relate to each other is where I think lots of human resilience is built.
Do you think the next part of your career, if you like, the Help for Heroes, Was that a natural progression for you to go from going through your recovery because you could relate to what your fellow colleagues would have gone through? Was that a natural part for you, or was that an opportunity that just opened at the right time?
It was both. I think it was a natural progression, but it also the door opened as I got to it. So as I was about to leave, Brim Parry, who was the co-founder of and CEO of Health for Heroes, he asked me if I'd join them and set their recovery services up. So, you know, in many ways, it couldn't have been more neat, but rather play into my sort of, as I said before, I've never really had a plan. You know, that opportunity it sort of arrived. I didn't plan for it. Actually, what was great about that was you could bring the experience of having just been through the system of trying to recover from injury, and all the really good skills and experience you gain as you move through a military career into creating something new and very rare. I mean, I was really privileged. You know, very rare are you given a blank piece of paper and just go and make something which achieves this. And that's what we did for 6 years, and it was great. And you know, you recruit some really good people. And I've always believed if you recruit good people, let them get on with their job. You don't micromanage them. And actually, I felt at the end of it, I was sort of standing on the shoulders of giants in many ways. I mean, the service was they created it. I just orchestrated it in many ways. And I think that's part of one of the things I learned in the military. It's one of the things that I think helps make organizations resilient, actually. You know, those relationships, employing good people, having trust in them, letting them get on with their job, nurturing them, mentoring them. You know, giving them, and you talked about failing occasionally. Don't worry about failing. And I think often I sort of believed in, you know, it does no harm to allow somebody who's developing in their career to fail, but never let them be a failure. And that's fundamentally different. You know, if you can allow them in a sort of controlled-ish way to cock it up a bit and learn from it.
Yeah,
they'll learn far more from that than you doing it for them.
Well, I think I watch the All Blacks, and watching the All Blacks play now when they're in an All Black jersey, I think when I watched Beauden Barrett, I think it was a game a couple of years ago, sprinting back, he might have been in the last World Cup, so England kicked a ball through, so it would have been on tour. England kicked a ball through, Beauden Barrett sprinting back. In my head, I'm thinking he's going to drop on that ball like I would have done. Don't want to put the risk of dropping it, knocking it on by actually using my hands. But, yeah. You know, he'll drop on that, secure it, his teammates will get there, look after him. But actually what he did was he literally half-bent, one-handed pick-up scoop. He was the only defender, and there were three England guys chasing, picked up with one hand, which gave him more time. He created more of an arc and was able to clear his own line.
That's what I would have done.
But
if your knees had let you.
Yeah, got booed. But I think the reason he could do that was because in New Zealand, they're allowed to fail. They're allowed to try those things time and time again. They're allowed to cock it up and get it wrong multiple times. And the reason he's then able to do it in an international arena is that he's not worried about it. And he's tried it numerous times. Yeah. He knows he can do it.
Yeah.
I think that whole piece for me is interesting.
Yeah, it's really important. And I look back, and I do attribute it to me in my early career. I was a 19-year-old second lieutenant. I was your nightmare platoon commander, but I was allowed to cock stuff up.
Mm.
And I took every opportunity to do it as well, and cock some things up spectacularly. But I learned from it, and it wasn't a black mark. It was a learning. Yeah. People went almost out of the way to make sure it was a way to learn. You've got a long way to go yet. You're only 19, you're only 20, whatever it was. And therefore, let's not worry about this too much. Let's learn from that. Do it again, we'll be worried.
Yeah.
And then move on. And I always tried to take that to my work when I was a more senior officer and also when I went to Health for Heroes.
I think there are plenty of sports coaches out there, certainly in the rugby world, that could learn from those two points in that management piece in terms of trusting other coaches around them to actually do their job and coach as well. And the players also to lead, but that failure piece I think is key for all sportsmen because we all have to do it.
Yeah, and I think you see, and I see in the work I do now, you know, you see and hear of lots of businesses where they're employing really good people, but they don't allow them any input into the business. They don't value them as individuals. They just want them to tick a box about what they do every day or hit a bottom line, and they're so tightly controlled they can't use their initiative. Well, if you want to do that, don't employ good people, just employ a robot.
Yeah,
and of course good people then leave. And they go and be the future somewhere else. And you think, okay, the world, I think, now is moving so fast around us, and faster in certain businesses than others, that if you don't develop a more networked, more autonomous, more delegated structure, you're going to be coming last.
Mm.
And, sports change, isn't it, in the way that it's...
Completely, yeah.
In exactly the same way. I think therefore there's loads of parallels you can draw from the sporting experience, from a military experience, and you look into the business experience, and I think, you know, they're joining those dots, and what you do is switch the play, and the potential that people can take into business is huge.
I want to just touch on something. You talked about creating something with Help for Heroes. I noticed that you were part of developing the Richmond trouser. Is that something I can go out and buy in on the local high street? Is that a fashion accessory that comes with I don't know, maybe in Leon's case, you know, pleats or something like that? He loves a nice trouser.
The Richmond trouser. God, I forgot all about that. Yeah, that was a...
What is it? What is a Richmond trouser?
So I had an external fixator on. So that's a...
Explain.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I was basically held together. My femur's held together by a big metal work, which is surgically attached, sort of through and through, holds you together. And, of course, it was so big, I couldn't have any trousers. It used to stick out the side.
Oh, it's external? External.
Well, it surgically goes through you.
Yeah.
But actually...
Like a frame on the outside. Frame. Yeah.
And you see quite a few people with them on there. Lower leg. Of course, I had it on my femur. And anyway, one of the... I can't remember which university it was. Decided they were going to design a trouser, now known as the Richmond trouser, which would cover that and also was made of a fabric which would be more antibacterial than others.
Oh, really?
And I sort of ended up as their model as they were trying to design it.
Antibacterial trousers, that would have been really useful for my time, you know, when I was diagnosed with IBS. You know, antibacterial trousers would have been perfect for any of those accidents that happened on the way to training. Yeah. I wish I'd known. When did you develop that? I mean, and why didn't I know about it at the time?
Yeah, if only you'd told us. Yeah. Gosh, that must have been 2010 or something, I guess. 2009? Really? Yeah.
And is that still in circulation?
I couldn't tell you. I wish I knew. I don't see why it wouldn't be.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just for people who need that sort of extra space and antibacterial qualities. So it might just be made specifically for you. Sure, they could make one for
I
you.
I might get you one for Christmas.
Extra space
Christmas.
And antibacterial.
You don't need the space, but I'll get you the antibacterial bit.
Probably get some warming knee pads or something.
Don't need any extra space. Who knew? Who knew we'd go on this on this trajectory during this conversation, talking about my toilet habits and need for extra room? Well, actually, not need for extra room in my trousers, but I'm fine down there. You were nicknamed the tripod, weren't you, Lloydie?
How did you go into the link? Was it that again? We're talking again, just keeping with the transition theme, going from there into Invictus Games. How did that come about? What was the that an opt-in or a selection process? How did that?
Well, I mean, so Prince Harry set up the Invictus Games. The first Games was 2014, I think, wasn't it? And Help for Heroes, we had a big sports, we called it a sports recovery program. So we were the sort of natural go-to people to generate the UK team.
Is that the one down at Tedworth?
Tedworth. So there's Tedworth, Catterick, Colchester and
Plymouth. Oh, there's a few, right.
And therefore we, I think, gosh, it was ridiculously short notice. It was something like 12 weeks notice, I think. Created the UK team, from finding out what the events were to running trials to getting kit to find out, you know, the whole thing was done in a really compressed time frame. All the time going into it, not really knowing what it was going to be. I mean, was it going to be a sort of a slightly larger sports day, or what? But of course, we also it surprised us all with the scale of it and the support. And then the following year. Following Games in Orlando, there was a partnership put together between Help for Heroes, Royal British Legion, the MOD, because they then added in the Sir Family component. And I sat on the partnership board for that, so it held that delegation together, but was still had sort of specific responsibility for the team. And I had a really good team of my own staff who ran the UK team in detail. So it was a really great experience, actually. And it was what wet my whistle a bit with the sort of looking at sport less from a competitor's perspective and more from a an administrator's perspective. And that's why I left Help for Heroes sometime later, I thought, okay, if I'm going to get, I wanted to give my time for nothing to something. So what would it be? And sport became the obvious route to go down. So I suppose that's what came out of it. But it's just a great event. I think actually the spirit of Invictus is that it's not about the winning of medals. Of course it's competitive. I mean, you put people in kit on a track against people, they get competitive. But probably some of the biggest stories and the biggest successes are people who are just there. They've got to the start, actually. They might have come last. It doesn't really matter. And that's where the benefit of it is. And I think actually the games for the competitors, it's not the end. It's how do you use this as a catalyst to power you forward? All the contacts you make, the experience you have, the confidence you get, the friendships you make, how can you take that experience and use it for the future?
Do you think it's retained that? Because obviously it's grown into this whole massive event now, global event. Has it retained that it's the taking part that counts, or has the natural sporting competitiveness got in the way of it's about beating the Americans?
I think it has. I'm pretty sure it's retained it. It always comes under a bit of pressure from the competition starts, but you want that.
It's sport.
I mean, if you're not going to compete, go and do something else.
Did you ever think about competing in it yourself? You know,
yeah. I was chairman of Selectus, so I might have been in a compromising position.
Slightly biased.
I've entered myself into the following events. Yeah, I did, but then I thought actually, I places were always tight. I was really enjoying the role I had, and I think this is a bit of the sort of this. Dare I say it, the sort of officer in you is if there's competitive, real competition for places, don't add to it. Mm. I mean, I might not have got picked anyway, to be honest. But I really enjoyed the role I had anyway. And therefore, I was really happy. I took a lot of enjoyment from just seeing the other guys and girls competing and helping getting it to there, rather than necessarily competing myself.
And do you think that role with Help for Heroes supported your transition? Because, you know, that was that's a big loss, I imagine, obviously leaving the military after 26 years and then having, you know, something to go into. Did the military prepare you for it? And if it didn't, what piece of information could you have been given that would have helped?
It helped massively. I think it was such an easy step to make and a huge challenge. It was all consuming for a long time because it was essentially us getting recovery services going. Is a bit like a startup business in many ways. I'm hugely grateful for the opportunity. I think it's when I left at the end of it, that was the point at which actually the way it helped was it gave me lots of contacts, which I then invested time in going to because I left and then thought, well, now what am I going to do? So I think this half of my transition was sort of delayed for 6 years in some ways, I guess. And that's how I sort of ended up doing what I do now. That's a variety of different things. I think the key bit for transition, I think, whether you're a military guy, a sportsman in the creative arts, whatever it is you need to understand who you are. So when you take the rugby shirt off or you take the uniform off, you need to know who's underneath because you're not that anymore. And it's you that gets the job. It's you that makes the decision. It's you who will move forward. Now that's not to say you have to forget about it all. You can't and you shouldn't forget about it all because it's an important part of how you got to here. Mm. But actually, if you don't really know who you are, the next step's going to be so much harder.
That's a real challenge, I think, in certainly in the sporting world with that non-athletic identity. So who you are when you're not wearing your kit, and I know that some of the work that I've done with the military guys as well, they recognise themselves as a military person, not a dad, a husband, a brother, until they're finished at the end, and it's quite difficult to try and develop themselves, their other identity whilst they're, because they're so single-minded in achieving their objectives. Yeah. I think it has a lot to play with it. I suppose the mental health side of preparing for that transition.
Yeah, and I think there's a period of time when you're in your sort of sporting prime in many ways, your late teens, early 20s, where you're probably too young to have really worked out who you are anyway. You're still finding that out. So that's no surprise. You shouldn't worry about it at that point. But I think as you get into the point where you have to then make some decisions about what next, just understanding who the person is, whose body you're walking around in, who are you, is a crucial early factor to work out. And then don't panic about it, I think. You know, and use the networks that we've all got, massive networks that we actually tap into a fraction of most of the time, be they sporting networks, military networks, whatever it is. I can't think of any time I've contacted somebody on a sort of networking sort of front when they haven't been helpful, or even if they're not able to help themselves, haven't pointed me to somebody else. So I think that would be, you know who you are and don't be frightened to go and speak to people.
And tell us what is it that you do now? What keeps you busy now?
Oh, lots of things actually, more things than I probably set out to do. I mean, I think the one I'm really pushing off on now is I co-founded with a lady in the States an organisation called Worldmaker International, which is about helping businesses, communities, first responders, veterans, and educators become more resilient, human resilience, both as individuals but also as collectives. It's not about infrastructure resilience. It's not about any of that kind of stuff. It's about how you as people and as communities can function better at times of trauma. And that's, I think, really exciting. I also do a bit of work with Switch to Play, transitioning athletes, which is really, I really enjoy that. And because they're always a demanding group of people, and that keeps you on your toes, and that's a good thing.
Obviously, a downside is you've got to work with Leon on on multiple days of the year.
Yeah, I know, but I can be more choosy. Demanding.
And have you found that because athletes are a unique bunch, how you relate your stories to the audience that you've been delivering to? How have you found that?
Yeah, I think they respond reasonably well. Actually, I think the fact that in the sporting context, I've been involved in sport. I think the military bit is always of interest. The fact that you get shot is a bit more interesting, I suppose. And I suppose there's the lived experience bit, which is key, isn't it? That I've been through this twice, and therefore maybe I've got something that may be of use to them by way of advice or insight. I like working with predominantly young people, because sports people are young people, aren't they, generally? And people who are sort of driven by something. And therefore, I find it the challenge I like to. So I think that relationship's gone well so far.
Yeah, it's been really good.
Is there obviously you've had a long and distinguished career on all those aspects. Is there anything that you would, on reflection, change about the career that you've had to date, other than being a professional sports player, maybe cricket, rugby, Worcester, or
You know, what would I change? I'm not sure I'd change much. I've enjoyed what I did. I've learned from the mistakes I've made. I was allowed to make lots of mistakes and learn from them. I've met some really interesting people and some really great people, and not necessarily people at the top of the tree either. And therefore, I think I'm quite blessed with the experience I've had. And you know, there's a few more years left in this old dog yet.
And from that wealth of experience, is there any advice? Is there a piece of information that you were given or have taken or have maybe learnt, developed that you could pass on?
Oh, that's a good one. I think never let the fear of failure stop you trying anything. Give it your best shot and be as much in control of your own destiny as you can be.
I think that's a good point to end on. David, it's been a pleasure listening to you and having you on the podcast today. Thanks very much for coming in. And to anyone that's been listening, if you've liked what you've heard, please rate, review, subscribe now to After the Whistle on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it just leaves us to say, David, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. And thanks, guys.
And Leon, cheers, mate.
Thanks.
Always good. Always good. Anything good to add? You normally have something really nice, light, insightful to add at the end. Brilliant. So we'll cut it there. Until next time, guys, thanks very much.